Press TV correspondent in Ukraine, Johnny Miller, says he's been placed on a kill list by Ukrainian ultra-nationalists after his revelations about violence against children in the Donbas region. Syria calls on the UN to condemn Israel's recent attack on the Damascus suburbs, saying it reserves the right to respond to the regime's repeated acts of aggression. And Donald Trump's former aide, Steve Bannon, is convicted of contempt of Congress for refusing to appear before a committee investigating last year's attack on the U.S. Capitol. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. Our top story: ever since the war in Ukraine began, Press TV has been closely following the developments there and keeping you up to date. Now, central to that effort has been our correspondent on the ground, Johnny Miller, reporting from the war-torn country. It was always going to present its own challenges and risks, but now Johnny says he's been placed on a kill list of an ultra-nationalist group in Ukraine. This after he reported on a story about a kill list associated with the Ukrainian government promoting violence against pro-Russian children in the region of the Donbas. A number of journalists have been killed in Ukraine after being put on that list.
The notorious Ukrainian website Mirotvorets, meaning peacemaker, it publishes the names and addresses of those it deems to be enemies of Ukraine. The opening page shows pictures of dead Russian soldiers. On the list are domestic and foreign journalists, politicians, and citizens that in some way they view to have aided or worked with pro-Russian forces in the country. Now, shamefully, they are adding children to the list. Faina Sevenkova, she is 13 years old and has been writing about her experiences here in Donbass. After her name appeared on the list, she started to receive threats of physical violence online.
Are you worried about being on the website? Are you concerned that something might happen to you?
Yes, of course. A person I knew got to know my address and came to greet me for my birthday. These are good intentions, but something worse can happen. Websites like this shouldn't exist. They're illegal. They put many people in danger, children as well. I have a friend who was put on there because she wrote a poem about war.
Numerous journalists and public figures have been murdered after being put on the list, like Oles Bazina, who was shot near his home in Kiev, and Andrea Rocelli, an Italian journalist. After he was killed on the front line, the website posted liquidated over his photo. The Committee to Protect Journalists has previously written to the Ukrainian government asking them to condemn the unfounded and damaging allegations published on Mirotvorets and to clarify publicly that the Ukrainian Interior Ministry is dedicated to protecting journalists. The United Nations and Human Rights Watch have also condemned the site. Dianis Bitkonen, a Finnish journalist in Donbass, he's also on the list.
It's all against all international laws, and you shouldn't have right, any country shouldn't have a right to do that kind of like hunting list, kill lists of people and put it to the public, especially. It's a very brutal way how to cause people serious problems, and many have lost their lives because of being on that list.
The website clearly states it provides information for law enforcement authorities and special services. Ukrainian government ministers have praised the site, and it is actively used by the authorities to track and detain enemies of the state.
While Western media and governments try to whitewash the extremist or far-right neo-Nazi elements here in Ukraine, calling it Russian propaganda, for a website promoted, supported, and used by the government that openly encourages violence towards children is a clear indication that Ukraine does have a serious problem with state-sponsored extremism. They're basically encouraging people to kill people on the list?
Yeah. That's why I've been in since 2015. I certainly cannot fall to the Ukrainian hands because I am on that list with several pages even. But like the old saying is that the others once terrorist is another one's freedom fighter, and hopefully all sense and truth and peace loving people understand that all these people in that list are heroes.
To openly encourage violence towards children takes a special kind of evil, an evil that NATO countries, as they continue to pump Ukraine with money, weapons, and political support, seem unwilling or incapable to challenge. Johnny Miller, Donbass.
We talked to independent German war correspondent Alina Lipp, who's been on the kill list of Ukraine's ultra-nationalists as well. She says the list endangers the lives of journalists in Ukraine.
Unfortunately, I'm familiar with this list. They put me on it last year in November. I just came here in October and stayed to cover the situation in Donbass in German, well, for Germans. And what I was doing practically was only translating interviews I did with people who live here in Donbass into German. And for that, they put me on this kill list, you can say. And I, for myself, also don't understand why, because I'm certainly not a kind of person you should kill or who should be killed. And John John now on this list. There's also a 13-year-old girl they put on it, and it definitely is dangerous, because there are several persons who they put on this list and then who have been killed afterwards. Well, actually, nobody knows about this list in the West because nobody is telling them, the people. There's a huge informational wall, blockade between Ukraine, Russia, and the West. So there are lots of lies and fakes they show to the, for example, the German people, and they just don't know what's going on here. And of course, this topic should be discussed more deeply, and people have to know about this, because it's really unbelievable and very dangerous for lots of journalists.
Meanwhile, Russia and Ukraine have signed a deal with the UN and Turkey on reopening Ukrainian Black Sea ports for grain exports. Russia's Defense Minister Sergei Shoigu and Ukrainian Infrastructure Minister Oleksandr Gubrakov each signed a separate but identical accord with the UN and Turkish officials at a ceremony in Istanbul. Parallel documents were signed as Ukrainian officials refused to put their names on the same documents, or on the same document, that is, as the Russians. The deal also aims to ease Russian grain and fertilizer shipments despite sanctions. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has hailed the accord as a beacon of hope.
The initiative we just signed opens a path for significant volumes of commercial food exports from three key Ukrainian ports in the Black Sea: Odessa, Chebonovsk, and Yuzhny. The shipment of grain and food stocks into world markets will help bridge the global food supply gap and reduce pressure on high prices.
Guterres also said the UN will set up a coordination center to monitor the implementation of the accord. European Union also praised the deal as a step in the right direction, calling for swift implementation. Now, according to top UN officials, the deal was expected to be fully operational in a few weeks. It comes amid growing concerns about a global food shortage, as the two warring countries are the world's biggest exporters of food products. Russia launched a military campaign in late February with the aim of demilitarizing and denazifying Ukraine. Moscow has repeatedly warned the flood of Western weapons will not force the country to end its offensive and will only prolong the war. Syria has called on the UN to condemn Israel's attack on a Damascus suburb on Friday that killed three soldiers and injured seven others. In separate letters to the UN Secretary General and the Security Council, Syria's foreign ministry said that Damascus reserves the right to respond to Israel's repeated acts of aggression. The ministry added the UN needs to take action to prevent Israel's attacks. Iran has also strongly denounced the Israeli raids as atrocious and clear violation of Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity. Tehran also criticized the silence of international bodies, especially the Security Council, in the face of what it called Israel's persisting crimes and dangerous behavior. Anti-Iran MKO terrorist group, which is based in Albania, postpones a summit scheduled for later in the month citing security reasons. Now, the terrorist cult says it's shelved a two-day meeting until further notice upon recommendation by the government. This after the U.S. Embassy warned American citizens against taking part in the event. Now, the meeting was set to be held on the 23rd and 24th of July in the group's Albanian base called Camp Ashraf 3. The MKO launched a series of bombings and assassinations in Iran, mostly in the 1980s. Iranian authorities hold the group responsible for the deaths of more than 17,000 Iranian citizens, but the cult has been enjoying freedom of activity in the West since being delisted as a terror group in the European Union and the U.S. in 2009 and 2012, respectively. Over the past years, dozens of Western politicians have taken part in the group's annual meetings in Europe. Over the past months, MKO agents have assaulted many Iranian nationals in several European countries. Just last month, a Press TV reporter and her news team were attacked while covering an exhibition in Sweden, which displayed crimes committed by the group. Historian Olsi Jasheshi joined us earlier from Tirana. He says there is more to the cancellation of the terrorist group summit than just alleged security concerns.
The Mujahideens, they are exactly like the Iranians call them, munafiqs, hypocrites. I mean, they use a lot of fake news. They always play the victim. If you see their propaganda here in Albania, they always claim to be victims of Iran. They have, in a way, brainwashed huge segments of Albanian society by playing the victim, even though they are the criminal. So I don't think that the cancellation of their event was related to the issue of security. The issue of security was, in a way, the excuse which the U.S. Embassy here in Tirana used in order to order the Mujahideens and our government as well to cancel their event. The Mujahideens, they are the most protected people here in Albania. They are even more protected than our president or prime minister. They are protected by our secret service, by a private army that they have, and the private Albanian security guards who guard them with weapons. So, I mean, any excuse or any claim that Mujahideens are threatened in any way possible is not true, but the opposite is true. The Mujahideens in the past months have launched a very dirty campaign against their defectors here in Albania. Around 500 Mujahideens have defected the cult, and around 50 are here in Tirana, who they refuse to be recruited as terrorist soldiers for Mariam Rajavi. What Rajavi has done, she has in a way managed to take over Albanian security services, and she is using the courts and the office of the prosecutors, anti-terrorism police, to harass the defectors. On the other hand, Rajavi and her cult, they have managed to buy most of the medias in Albania. Most journalists here in Albania, they are terrorized by the Mujahideens. They do not report anything against them because they know that they immediately can lose their job. So the claim that Mujahideens are threatened in any way possible is a pure lie.
Commander of the Navy of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps has warned about the consequences of Israel's presence in the Persian Gulf. Rear Admiral Adireza Tangsiri said that the regime is getting a foothold in the area will only cause insecurity and incite sedition. The IRGC commander also denounced Israel as the number one enemy of Muslims. He was speaking in a meeting with the visiting commander of Oman's Navy, Rear Admiral Saif bin Nasser al-Rahbi. Both officials stressed that the security of the region should be preserved by the Persian Gulf countries without the presence of foreigners. Two countries held a joint military drill in the Strait of Hormuz and Sea of Oman in December last year as part of efforts to develop bilateral ties. UN brokered truce to halt the war in Yemen will expire August 2nd. Yemen's National Salvation Army has now set new demands to accept the extension of a ceasefire with a Saudi-led coalition for another 6 months, Abdul Latif Al-Washali reports.
As the United Nations is pushing the warring sides in Yemen to renew the truce, the Sana'a government has set new conditions to accept the extension for a third period of 6 months. The head of Yemen's national negotiating delegation, Mohammed Abdel Salam, said the United Nations is now required to ensure the payment of all salaries which are suspended since 2016.
If the leadership in Sana'a accept the extension of the truce, the commitment under the agreement should be implemented from the first day of the truce. The blockade must be lifted by land, sea and air. All roads must be opened and the salaries of Yemeni employees must be paid. The oil wells must be preserved and the suffering of prisoners should be ended. Without this, the truce has no meaning.
Experts say it is likely that Sana'a rejects the terms of the current truce and pushes the United Nations to further ease the suffering of Yemenis by disbursing salaries.
It is clear from the political and military statements of Sana'a that they will not accept the request to extend the ceasefire easily. There are new demands by Sana'a to enter a third period of the agreement. The United Nations must fulfill previous commitments and deal with the new conditions positively. Otherwise, there will be a military escalation.
Yemen's demands come against the backdrop of United Nations failure to force the Saudi-led coalition to fulfill its commitments under the current agreement that was brokered by the world body in early April.
Disappointing and useless, that's how Yemenis describe the current UN brokered agreement. They say the Yemeni army should be prepared for different scenarios, including military escalation. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
A jury has convicted a top advisor to former U.S. President Donald Trump of contempt of Congress. Steve Bannon was found guilty for refusing to appear before a congressional committee investigating the January 6, 2021 storming of the U.S. Capitol by Trump supporters. Bannon was subpoenaed by the January 6 committee last September. Now he's facing up to 2 years in prison. A former Trump ally had served as chief strategist to then-president before being fired in 2017. Trump supporters raided Congress in January of 2021 to block the certification of Joe Biden as U.S. president amid allegations of voter fraud. Five people were killed during the unrest. Thank you for tuning in and goodbye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
As the U.S. Fed raises interest rates, dollar-denominated loans become an unsustainable burden to states around the globe. In this regard, we have prepared for you an article written by Philip and Mann titled, "The U.S. Selfish War on Inflation Will Tip the World into Recession." Please stay with us to hear more about the story. Later in July, U.S. interest rates are expected to jump for a second time this year, and that's going to wreck any chance of a global recovery. The Federal Reserve could push its base rate up by as much as a full percentage point, ending 15 years of ultra-cheap money, intended to promote growth. This jump to a range of 2.5% to 2.75% would take the cost of borrowing money in the U.S. to more than double the Bank of England's 1.25%. And yet, the Fed could just be taking a breather as it contemplates even higher rates. Though this column is not about the U.S., it is concerned with the terrible impact on Britain and countries across the world of America's selfish disregard when it decides to tackle high inflation with higher borrowing costs. Britain is already feeling the effects of the Fed's pledge to tackle inflation until it is defeated, come what may. U.S. officials claim higher interest rates in the U.S. make it an attractive place for investors to store their money. But to take full advantage, investors must sell their own currency and buy dollars, sending the price of dollars rocketing higher. In July, the U.S. dollar increased in value against a basket of six major currencies to a 20-year high. The euro has slipped below parity with the dollar in the last few days. The pound, which has plunged by more than 10% this year to below $1.20, is losing value with every week that passes. In Japan, the central bank has come under huge pressure to act after the yen tumbled to its lowest level against the dollar since 1998. There are two important knock-on effects for those of Americans that live and work outside the U.S. The first is that goods and raw material priced in dollars are much more expensive, and most commodities are priced in dollars, including oil. Borrowing in dollars also becomes more expensive, and while getting a loan from a U.S. bank is beyond the average British household, companies do it all the time, and especially those in emerging economies where funds in their backyard can be in short supply. The Bank of England interest rate setter Catherine Mann recently said that her main motivation for wanting significant increases in the UK's lending rates was her fear that the widening gap with the dollar was pushing up import prices, and higher import prices meant higher inflation. If only she could persuade her colleagues on the bank's Monetary Policy Committee that the devaluation of the pound was a serious issue, maybe they would push up the bank's base rate in line with the Fed rate increases. After the Fed makes its move, more may join her. Until January this year, Britain's inflation surge was on the course to be short-lived. Now, it seems the Russian special operation in Ukraine and a splurge of untargeted handouts by the Biden administration during the coronavirus pandemic, which have served to push up prices in America, will keep inflation in the UK high into next year. Those governments that have borrowed in dollars face a double whammy. Not only will they need to raise domestic interest rates to limit the impact of import price rises, they will also face a massive jump in interest payments on their dollar borrowings. Emerging markets and many developing world countries will be broke when these extra costs are combined with a loss of tourism from the COVID pandemic. Sri Lanka has already gone bust, and many more could follow. Zambia's government borrowed heavily before the pandemic to become self-sufficient in electricity. It is a laudable aim, but has left the Central African state with a ratio of debt to national income much the same as France, about 110%. The problem for Zambia is not the same as for France, which pays an interest rate of 1.8% to finance its debts, measured by the yield on its 10-year bonds. The Zambian 10-year bond commands a rate of 27%. Now Zambia, like France and so many other countries, must borrow simply to live. To invest is to borrow more. There is no sign that the U.S. will change course. Joe Biden is in a panic about the midterm elections when fears of a spiraling inflation could favor the Republicans. This panic has spilled over to the Fed, which has adopted hysterical language to persuade consumers and businesses that higher rates are coming down the track and to curb their spending accordingly. Meanwhile, the price of oil rose on Monday, July 18th, after the U.S. President Joe Biden came away from talks in West Asia without an agreement on raising supply. Biden had hoped to secure a promise from Saudi Arabia to increase its output of oil, which could lead to an easing of global supply pressures. But Brent crude rose 2.6% to $103.88. After Saudi Arabia's Foreign Minister Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud quelled speculation over an output increase. He said that officials at U.S.-Arab summit on Saturday, July 16th, did not discuss oil and that the OPEC oil cartel nations would continue to assess market conditions. Naeem Aslam, the chief market analyst at Ava Trade, said the message is that it is OPEC Plus that makes the oil supply decision and the cartel isn't remotely interested in what Biden is trying to achieve. He said OPEC Plus will continue to control oil supply and one country alone cannot determine the oil supply. At least that is the message that traders have taken from Biden's visit to Saudi Arabia. The increase in oil prices will keep up the pressure at the pumps, where drivers have faced record petrol and diesel prices. Prices have climbed so high that the government asked the Competition and Markets Authority to study the market, and its initial findings raised concerns over the margins made by refineries. Thus, the U.S. Fed knows inflation is a problem born of insufficient supply that only governments can take. But that doesn't look like stopping it from pushing the U.S. economy and everyone else's into recession.
Back to reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, sisters and brothers. This is Asma, and I have the privilege to be your host for today's discussion. Well, here with me, I have two very dear and credible guests, Sister Zainab and Brother Muzaffar. It's been so long since the last time I met you two, and today I am over pleased to have you both in one picture. Okay, ladies, first I'll start with you, Sister Zainab. Assalamu alaikum. And how are you doing?
Assalam. Thank you so much.
I'm glad.
Doing great, alhamdulillah. Thank God. Totally psyched to be here with you guys.
So pleasure to be with you. And you, brother, assalamu alaikum. And how's life?
Wa alaikum salam. Life is good, alhamdulillah. And I'm here after such a long time.
And it's great to be back. Great to be with you.
Thanks
too.
Thanks for having me.
So, just as the ritual of this program, I would love you two to give me a very short introduction about yourself. And let's start with you, brother Muzaffar.
Yeah, so I'm Muzaffar Haider. Mm-hmm. I'm born and raised in the UK. I'm studying in the Hausa. And now I occasionally show up at IRIB English Radio and discuss some interesting topics with you.
Of course.
Of course. And you, sister?
I'm Zainab. I'm a student of philosophy.
Well, sister, I'd start with you. Are you married?
Getting there.
So in the process. And you, brother?
I'm married, yeah, alhamdulillah.
So you already have an experience.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you ask others to get married?
Yeah, yeah. I often encourage youth, especially, to get married.
Mm-hmm. Actually, before we were coming, you were saying something to someone on the phone.
There's a sister out there and she was saying, you know, how she's not married and she's wanting to get married. She really wants to get married, but she's not finding anybody. What should I do? So I was telling her that, you know, you need to be patient and, you know, you can keep trying, try marriage websites, etc.
So you think these applications or websites or whatever that are available in net are a good way of getting married?
Something that we often look down upon and we often feel like, oh, why should I go to a marriage website? Mm-hmm. It's kind of beneath me. I think we shouldn't feel that way. We should use the internet to connect with people who want to connect with us, especially if it's for the noble cause of marriage. Remember, the Holy Prophet sallallahu alaihi wa alihi wasallam said that marriage is my institute and one who abandons my institute is not from me. And this is a very heavy hadith right here. In today's society, it is looked at as something very light, something very trivial, especially in the West. Now, you know, men and men can get married, women and women can get married. In France, a woman married a tree. Over there, somebody married, I don't know, an animal. It's just getting ridiculous.
Oh, and they married themselves.
Those who marry themselves.
Like, what do you mean you married yourself? Why are you announcing that? You know, marriage is actually something very sacred, something very pure. وَلَيْسَ الذَّكَرُ كَالْأُنْثَى. The Quran says the male is not like the female. Guys, can we get these basic things down, please? Society, especially in the West, is trying to drag and pull everybody away from these basic fundamental realities of human life and the sacredness of relationships. You know, marriage is just such a pure thing from the Islamic perspective that if a person belonging to another religion, right, they're not even Muslim, but they get married.
Yeah.
Then that couple becomes Muslim. Islam accepts their marriage.
Nikah. You don't have to destroy your institution.
You already are married. Mm-hmm. Think about that. That means that in other religions, when two people get married, even if it's not done in an Islamic way, if it's done in a Christian way, a Jewish way, whatever. Subhanallah, Allah accepts that to a lesser or greater extent.
Mm-hmm. Let's go for a little break. We'll be back in no time. Dear audience, stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
So, welcome back to your audience. This is IRIB English Radio. We are having a discussion in your Back to Reality. Now, I want to ask your idea about governmental encouragements. Do you think is it a duty for the governments to make such encouragements for the youth to get married or in order not to decline their marriage?
The government should make it easy. I don't know about encouragement.
Should the government facilitate?
Oh, absolutely not. It's not the place of the government at all to stick its nose into people's private affairs, but it should definitely facilitate it. Mm-hmm. If, especially we see that in Muslim societies where the youth shy away from marriage because, you know, it's the stress of, well, having a house and having a car and having a steady income. So I firmly believe that the government should facilitate accommodate the needs that young couples or even older couples or whatever couples have in order for them to focus more on their relationship than having to stress over the fact that, can I pay rent this month, right? There should be some loans. There should be easier, more lenient conditions in loan giving for banks and stuff like that, which... You know, it exists in a lot of countries.
I would disagree to a certain extent with Sister Zainab here. I think governments should encourage marriage. Yeah. I think they should encourage it. Notice the wording. I didn't say enforce, right?
Yeah.
Encourage.
So you mean there's no law?
No, let's define encourage real quick.
I mean, making it easy and facilitating for it is a kind of encouragement, right?
You should promote it, though.
See, what's
happening
is...
Go around putting banners up.
Yeah, no. What's happening is I'm looking at the opposite, and what they're actually essentially facilitating divorce. I'm looking at the West. If you look at the statistics, especially in a country like the UK, it is awful. Like the advantages that a woman has in divorce, she doesn't have in marriage.
Exactly.
Right. You can just marry a guy and then split his wallet in half and just go away with the money. That's better for you. You know, go and live your life. That individualistic mindset. The reason why governments, whether they're Islamic or not, should encourage marriage is because it prevents so many societal harms. One of my teachers once said that there's no point in spraying each individual fly. You need to get rid of the garbage itself, which is encouraging the flies to enter the house, for example. It's the same thing.
So you basically, if they do that, divorce, if they accommodate and facilitate, they would be encouraging.
Yeah. Encourage it, right? Mm. But you said it quite emphatically that they definitely shouldn't encourage. I think, governments should do amr bil ma'ruf, right? They should enjoin the good. But anyway, I wanted to say that, look, you're stopping drugs, right, in the streets. You're stopping gang crime. You're stopping this. It's just like playing whack-a-mole. What's the point? If you look at the sources of these things, it's because they come from broken households, right? Most of these parents, they're divorced. And so when this child comes home from school, he's not getting that upbringing that he needs. His mind is split into two. And so that frustration which is created in the child from a young age and that lack of warmth and love and care that he needs from a family unit is not being given to him. And so... he feels like, why shouldn't I go towards drugs and alcohol? And why shouldn't I steal a car and go for a joyride? That's where all the crime is coming from.
Mm-hmm. I would like you to talk about the ways of encouragement.
Yeah, exactly. The part you said the government has to do amr bil ma'ruf wa nahy anil munkar, enjoin the good and forbid the bad. Well, there are different forms of doing that, aren't there?
Oh, yeah.
It's like this is one of the most suckish things about our society, the Muslim society, is that they think amr bil ma'ruf wa nahy anil munkar means walking up to a person and telling them that, you know what you're doing right now? It's wrong. You should stop doing it.
But that but denying that is one of the forms as well.
It's one of the most horrible forms. I am okay with people encouraging each other, right, to have good marriages, right? Because some people have this mindset of getting married for the sake of being married.
Yeah.
I see that more often in women also, because they don't want to turn into like lonely, crazy cat ladies. And there's this mentality, especially in the Middle East, that a woman expires after a certain age and you're not going to find suitors anymore.
Yeah,
and now you're just left on your parents' hands and no one wants you.
You're out of use.
Yeah, exactly. Sure, we can encourage each other in the most... encouraging way possible.
Not encourage each other in a way
that the person says, I don't know who you are. This is none of your business. Stop talking to me and then walk away. Because, you know, people think they're encouraging, but that's what they end up doing. Mm. encouraging people to get into good marriages can look like having a good marriage yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Set an example.
Oh, wow.
That is so important.
Yeah, practical
yes,
way of
encouraging.
Yes,
practical encouragement. You can't go around telling people, oh, why didn't you get take the supplementary pill. It's so good. I took it. I got cancer, though. And people are like, so why are you advocating
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that's very true.
Right?
Yes.
So have a good marriage first. If you
hold
wanted-
on. What if your relationship is a mess? That's not fair, really, right? My relationship is a mess, but you should still get married, right? It might be better for you.
One time, a mom came up to Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam and told His Eminence, please tell my kid to stop eating dates. We know dates are good, but he's overdoing it. And Rasulullah was like, come back tomorrow. And then the mom took the kid, and it's such a famous story too,
yeah.
Brought him back tomorrow, and then Rasulullah was like, hey kid, stop eating dates.
Mm-hmm.
And then the mom was like, what the, you could have said this yesterday. Mm-hmm. And Rasulullah was like, I was eating dates yesterday. I don't want to preach what I don't do. It's so delicate, this topic. And people are so touchy.
Exactly.
The moment they find out your marriage is falling apart, they'd be like, oof. Who do you think you are telling me what to do? Go fix your own life.
You're an example of please don't get married.
Exactly. So there's that sort of encouragement.
Yeah.
Have a good marriage yourself before you want to advocate marriage.
So there's, I'm not with that direct way of telling people, please go marry. It's good to get married.
I do that all the time. I don't really do it with sisters though. That's the difference, I think. I don't really, because I've got lots of youths who are brothers, and I literally go up to them and go, brother, are you married? Yeah. Why not?
Yes, it's among your people.
They're usually younger as well. There's
an
age gap,
so
and I can.
It's okay. Mm-hmm. If it's in a friendly situation, you
can do it. Yeah.
But if you see like a 30-something-year-old man or woman, imagine this scenario. You see a 30-year-old man or woman, and then you ask, hey, so why aren't you married? And then the person is like, oh, I have really bad experience. You know, she turned out to be a horrible person. She dragged me into an ugly divorce. She took half of my possessions and took full custody of the kids. I haven't seen my children in four years.
God.
I spiraled
such
into horrible depression.
I'm sorry I asked.
Exactly. So I think there should be a limit to how much questions can we ask regarding a person's private lives. That's like another form of encouragement I'm talking about. I mean, people ask this question all the time, are you married? And the person's like, no. And then the best comment you can give is a form of encouragement. I hope you find someone who makes you happy. End of discussion.
Exactly.
Don't ask them why. Don't ask them what are your conditions. I hope you find someone that makes you happy. And it's a prayer. And then they live and let live.
That's a really good, I like that. Okay, what if that person has financial problems?
Well, if that person is really wants to get married, right, and they've embraced your positive prayer of compassion regarding marriage, and they're actively trying to get married, and they have an obstacle, like a financial problem, they will express it. Let them express it on their own terms. Brother, you haven't married. Well, I hope you find someone you're looking for, bro. If you need anything, you let me know.
Okay, so we were talking of marriage, and I hope we made our point. I hope you all have a great life. Thank you for listening.
Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabb. Let the Ummah rise again. Ya Allah, Ya Rabb al-Alamin, Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Rabbi. Let the Ummah rise again. Let us see daylight again, once again.
IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
While Palestinians and democratic legislators press for justice for Shirin Abu Aqile, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee expressed its profound disappointment at the Biden administration's treatment of the civil and human rights of Arab Americans generally and Palestinian Americans specifically. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Maureen Claire Morphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading, Biden Can't Ignore the Apartheid Elephant in the Room. Stay tuned for more. Joe Biden's administration appears determined not to let the Palestinians and their tiresome demands for justice and liberation put a damper on his visit to the occupied Palestinian territories. Biden was asked during an interview with Israeli regime TV about progressive members of the Democratic Party who call Israel an apartheid regime and support ending unconditional aid to Tel Aviv. Biden said, "There are few of them. I think they are wrong. I think they are making a mistake. Israel is our ally. Israel is a friend. And I think that I make no apologies." But there is only so much the U.S. president, intent on shoring up U.S. hegemony in the region, can do to avoid acknowledging the apartheid elephant in the room. A U.S. State Department announcement clearing the Zionist regime of direct responsibility for the killing of Al Jazeera correspondent and U.S. citizen Shirin Abu Aqile, issued on the 4th of July holiday, has done little to turn attention away from the crime. Instead, it has only generated more questions and raised eyebrows over the apparent U.S. role in the Israeli regime cover-up of responsibility for her death while she was covering a military raid in the West Bank city of Jenin. The U.S. State Department, citing an extremely detailed forensic analysis, said the bullet that killed Abu Aqile was too badly damaged for U.S. officials to definitively determine who fired it. Yet, paradoxically, the U.S. State Department also insists on the basis of this inconclusive evidence that there is no reason to believe that her killing was intentional. Al-Haq, a Palestinian human rights group, noted that the examination of the bullet by U.S. officials was conducted without the participation of the State of Palestine or even an expert representing Abu Aqile's family. The group said that the U.S. State Department announcement was of a political nature rather than a professional one, which promotes impunity and constitutes a desperate attempt to hide the truth and shield the perpetrators. Amnesty International stated recently that Abu Aghila's killing provided a stark reminder of the crimes committed by Israeli regime authorities to maintain their system of oppression and domination over Palestinians and of the U.S. role in shielding Israel from accountability. The human rights group added that the Biden administration and U.S. Congress must stop the supply of arms to the Israeli regime military until it is guaranteed that such equipment would not be used for serious violations of international humanitarian and human rights law. On the eve of Biden's arrival, the press freedom watchdog Reporters Without Borders called on U.S. authorities to open a criminal investigation into Abu Aghila's death. Last week, Abu Aghila's family demanded that Biden meet with them during his visit and share with them all of the information the U.S. has gathered regarding the killing. Antony Blinken, the U.S. Secretary of State, reportedly called the family and invited them to the U.S. for a sit-down discussion instead. Anton Abu Aghila, the slain journalist's brother, told media that there was no date set for the meeting and he hoped that Biden would attend. What's important and what we want to get to is justice for Shirin, he told Tel Aviv Daily Haaretz. Lina Abu Aghila, the late Al Jazeera correspondent's niece, wrote in an op-ed for Al Jazeera that they want the FBI and the USSA Department to reveal not only the chain of command and orders given when the shot was fired, but also to reveal what weapons were used in Shirin's killing and how those weapons were purchased. If the weapon that killed my aunt is connected to U.S. military aid, Lina Abu Aghila added, Biden must explain to us why the U.S. government finds it acceptable that a foreign government kills U.S. citizen with weapons purchased by U.S. taxpayers. The U.S. provides an unconditional minimum of $3.8 billion in military assistance to the fake regime of Israel each year. In her op-ed, Abu Aghila pointed to the lack of accountability for the death of 78-year-old Omar Asad, another Palestinian with U.S. citizenship earlier this year. The grandfather had a stress-induced heart attack while being arbitrarily detained and abused by Israeli regime troops while returning home from visiting relatives in his West Bank village. The White House continues to feel the heat from the president's party, with six Democratic senators issuing two separate letters to Biden after the State Department's 4th July announcement. One of those letters was issued by ranking Senator Dick Durbin, Chris Murphy, Chris Van Hollen, and Patrick Leahy, who authored a law barring violators of human rights from receiving U.S. training and equipment. That letter states that the United States Security Coordinator's review of the findings reached by the Israeli regime military and the Palestinian Authority in their respective investigations of Abu Aghila's death falls short of the independent probe demanded by dozens of members of Congress. In their letter, the senators seek clarity on the role of the U.S. agencies in the USSC review and the nature of the material reviewed, including whether it included the investigations conducted by the New York Times, The Washington Post, CNN, The Associated Press, and the UN Human Rights Office, all of which pointed to Israeli regime responsibility for Abu Aghila's death. They ask which specific evidence led to USSC's conclusion that there is no reason to believe that Abu Aghila's killing was intentional, but rather the result of tragic circumstances. The senators also ask whether the USSC determined whether the Israeli regime military questioned the troop who fired the rifle that the Zionist regime says may have been used to kill Abu Aghila. Senators ask, did the USSC, FBI, or any other U.S. agencies request to interview the soldier? Meanwhile, Senator Bob Menendez, chair of the Committee on Foreign Relations, and Cory Booker, who has supported federal legislation encouraging states to punish supporters of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement for Palestinian rights, are also demanding answers from Biden. We urge you to raise Ms. Abu Aghalé's case at the highest level and press for accountability during your upcoming visit on the West Bank, the senators stated in their letter to Biden. The senators asked Biden for a senior-level classified briefing on the investigation details, including American involvement, with the utmost urgency. While Palestinians and Democratic legislators press for justice for Shirin Abu Aghalé, the American Arab Anti-Discrimination Committee expressed its profound disappointment at the Biden administration's treatment of the civil and human rights of Arab Americans generally and Palestinian Americans specifically. The ADC said it has serious concerns over the Biden administration's desire to admit the Zionist regime into the visa waiver program, despite the systematic and discriminatory way they treat Arab Americans. Tom Knight, the U.S. ambassador to occupied Palestinian territories, recently tweeted that he had been working around the clock to help Israel meet all the requirements to join the program. "This will help Israeli citizens travel to the U.S. put them first," he said. Earlier, ADC stated in a letter to Biden that currently American citizens who hold Palestinian identity cards are not able to fly into territories. Instead, they must travel to Jordan and enter via Al-Anbari Bridge, a process that can take hours should every aspect go correct. The civil liberties group added that Arab Americans who only hold American passports face extended periods of interrogation when arriving in Tel Aviv, and their entry into the country is determined by how the particular border control agent feels that particular day. There is no world in which these types of restrictions and requirements comport with the reciprocity necessary for inclusion in the visa waiver program, the ADC stated. Meanwhile, new regulations from COG-80, the bureaucratic arm of the Zionist regime's military occupation, will require Palestinian Americans who want to visit their family in the West Bank to apply to Israeli regime authorities for permission ahead of time.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.